Great teaching happens when teachers get time to think. Walk into an Educate classroom and you'll find a consistent approach to homework, teachers who know where knowledge gaps are, and students who are doing regular retrieval practice. With Educate, you can be free from marking homework by the end of the week. Students have now answered over 1 billion questions on Educate. If you're looking to set up centralised homework and revision in your geography department, you won't be disappointed. Your first month is free at www.educate.co.uk/geography.
Welcome, everybody. It's this is a live Geographical Association podcast, but they haven't given us a microphone, so we'll have to shout into that one for the recording, but shout it a bit louder. So I hope you can hear us at the back there. We're using our best teacher voices. Anyway, I'd like to welcome Donald McLean. He spent 40 plus years working in education. So you'd think it might be time to sit back and relax. But no, he's not slowing down. This afternoon, we'll be sharing insights into, in a personal capacity, he did want me to say, on a range of subjects. We're going to start talking about his teaching career. But he's been in education management. He's worked in schools across the country, actually. But he's also responsible for Walking for Health. I don't know if you've heard of it, but you will do by the time we finish, Black Men Walking. And finally, something I don't know too much about anymore, barbers. How barbers can support Black men's mental well-being. I've spent about half an hour with Donald, just chatting over what we're going to say. And I think, get ready to be inspired, get ready to be challenged, but get ready to be empowered, I think, to take action, because it's been a fascinating half hour. We could have recorded it for the podcast before we started.
Probably better.
So please join me in giving a warm welcome to the exceptional Donald McLean. This is the plan. One of the teachers I worked with right at the beginning in 1973 said, no plan survives first contact with the enemy. And he meant it in terms of teaching plans. It'll always go wrong when you start putting it in front of a class. But we're going to chat. We can take questions at the end. But I think with such a small group, we can also take questions, as long as you're happy with this.
Yeah.
We can take questions anytime. So if you've got something, stick your hand up and we'll go through what it is and try and make this interactive, not just between us two, but between all of us in the room. So I want to start, and I've looked around the room, and I know there's not many of us here, but it is still an all-white audience. So I've got a quote, which I want to give you. It's a 2020 quote by Francisca Rocchi. She was a York St. John University student, and she tweeted this. I've still got the tweet. I wish geography, environmental studies, and related subjects were more diverse. I'm the only Black girl on my course. I know it's the same at other universities across the country. So, Donald, your story must have been even more intense 40 years ago. So without role models, what inspired you, first of all, to be a geographer and to have the career that you've got?
Well, thank you very much. Thank you very much for the, inviting me. Thank you, Christine. Don't know if it's a thank you, but it's Christine who told me about this event and asked if I'd like to be on it. And I said, yes. I think the main reason why I wanted to be here was to, in a sense, just be a part of the conversation still. And it is very much about a conversation, because in that conversation, you're thinking about what it is you want to sort of like contribute to, you know, education, contribute to schooling, contribute to making young people think and making young people or supporting young people in terms of them being, you know, ready for the world out there. And that world, which I remember as a secondary school child in Nottingham, inner city Nottingham in the 70s, was a very, very small world. And whenever I go back to Nottingham and I just sort of go where I live, where I was brought up, for nearly all youngsters, and we were talking about perceptual geography earlier, or psychological geography or whatever, and my world was tiny. Really, really tiny. And, you know, the first 10 years, it was two up, two down housing, and it was terraced housing. And for me, the countryside was just a park. I didn't know what countryside was, basically. It was just a park. But it was at secondary school where the geography teacher invited us to go on a walk to Kinder Scout. I didn't know it was called Kinder Scout. He just said, we're going to Derbyshire. And I thought, yeah, I'll go on that. And I remember I borrowed a pair of Doc Martens from one of the skinheads in the class. that was appearing. So there was probably Doc Martens and going up Kinder Scout. And we got to the top, and it was 1975. And it had been a really, really wet spring, but it was turning into a really glorious summer. But the Kinder Scout was just, we were going up and down in the peat box, and it was, I remember it so well because it was so different. That was a key bit to me. It was completely different to anything I knew and understood and had experienced. And for me, that's what geography did. You know, the lessons which I had in geography, it was about places I didn't know, and I was trying to make sense of where I was in my world as such. And that's how I got into geography, you know, and I've still got that love of trying to make some sense of where I am in the world. And that's what I wanted to convey in my education and career, is to help support young people make sense of where they are, who they are in this world, and to help them to better understand the changes and the forces which are operating on them at all times, even when maybe they're not aware of those forces, that they may get a little bit better insight of those forces operating on them.
It is interesting, isn't it? I don't know about you in the audience, but I went back. I don't go back to Stockton very often, but I'm from Stockton. And I went back and met a mate of mine who I hadn't seen for about 10 years. And we decided that we would do our world. And we'd driven through it in about 5 minutes. Honestly, it was the same as you said, that it was a really tiny little area that was our world. And beyond that, we hadn't explored much at all. And when I took students like you, I took students from Sheffield, where I taught, into the Peak District. They went past where I lived, and it was about, I suppose, 12 miles from the house. And I was saying, you don't have to live a long way away from school, you, sir. And then they thought it was at the end of the world. How do you get in the morning? Well, I've got to drive. And they'd never been to the Peak District. We took them to a little scout centre in Great Hucklow for a week. That was White Tents. And that was beyond their world. They were going to go down the pit, and that was their world. And they would even say to me, not because I couldn't understand what they were saying when I first went to teach them, they'd say to me things like, what's in this napkin, sir? Pardon? What's in this napkin? And another lad would say, he's asking you, what's in your packed lunch? Oh, aye. And they'd say, there's a doggy thee. What? Oh, he's saying he's not very clever. I couldn't understand them. And they reckoned that you could tell the difference between somebody from Treaton and somebody from Catcliffe, the two mining villages. But their worlds were so tiny. And children's worlds are tiny. But that's not answered my question, really, about why is geography still white?
Well, you asked me that earlier, and I had no answer to it. And I still have no answer to it. And why do I think it is? If I'm going to venture, I think my experience of teaching geography and going to events like this and the curriculum, etc. I've heard people say that geography sometimes can be very negatively received. The way in which it's sort of like, it's, you know, back in the, when I first started teaching in the 80s, you know, the world which geography presented back to people of where people may have come from. So my family came from the Caribbean, or if you people came from West Africa, or came from India, or came from East Africa. This was a world which was sort of like one of starving babies and of famine and of this and that. That's what people saw around them, not necessarily always in geography, but that was the sort of like the bigger image they got. When I was a kid, one of the many insults we used to get at school was "you're Biafran." So that was about the civil war in Nigeria in the 60s, and I think it's the Igbo land. And that's what I think people got in the 80s. That's a representation, a very negative representation of other worlds, worlds which were not this sort of like British-centric, Eurocentric, Western-centric. And there was little attempt to actually explore the sort of power dynamics which exists between different parts of the world and how resources are allocated, etc. Now, I don't think it's like that now, and it hasn't been like that for a while, but I think that type of image has stuck with geography quite consistently in a way in which other subjects, let's talk about history, for instance, doesn't have that in the same way. And I think maybe in history, there's ability to explore more politics around it than there is in geography. I think as well, geography sometimes struggles to actually get people to think, well, what can I do with geography? You know, where's it going to take me as such? And when you say something like, well, geography's got this whole catalogue of skills which can be transferable skills, that's quite a difficult thing for someone who's 15 and thinking, actually, if I'm going to stay on in education, it's got to actually get me something. You know, it's going to get me a job, which is going to get me a career, which is going to take me on. And maybe geography struggles sometimes to actually portray that. Again, maybe wrongly, but that might be how it's perceived by some communities. I think as well, you know, it's the chicken and the egg. Geography, like in teaching, doesn't seem to be that popular with Black and minority ethnic people as a subject to teach. And I think teaching per se, I don't think it's got much better over the years. I've still not answered your question because I'm being reluctant to answer your question because I don't really know why it is. I do know is there is a persistence in that situation.
I did used to get phone calls when I was program manager at the GA. I'd get phone calls from parents sometimes saying, what's the point of geography? And it was quite often Indian subcontinent parents who were asking that. I want my children to be doctors. I want them to be engineers. I want them to be accountants. I can't see the point of geography. Was an interesting question that I got relatively regularly. Yeah. I don't know why people picked up on the GA as being the person to phone up and ask, but I did get asked that sometimes. So what's the point of geography is an interesting one for parents to pick up because it is complicated.
It is, yeah. I'm going to flip it around. I think that utilitarian sort of aspect of education, of geography, I don't really go with. I'm very much a believer in the passion, you know, that you really are still about trying to excite young people about what it is they're experiencing in that classroom setting. Something which sort of like gets them energized about the learning itself, that it's opening up doors for them. And when you can do that, then that's when you start getting people saying, I'm going to pursue that line of inquiry. Trying to convince people about this is what you can do with something, I don't really think works. I think it's about you in a classroom and the students is able to say, that really got me excited. It made me think differently about where I am in this world at this moment in time, even if they can't necessarily comprehend it in that way at that time, but it's got them thinking slightly differently than they did before.
There aren't that many role models, are there still, though, of Black role models for geography? We were talking earlier about when you and even when you're portraying, say, Africa, not as a country, although that's how sometimes it's seen, But when you portray elements of it, Disney portray images of animals like they do in The Lion King. The story's not told through people, it's told through a vector.
Yeah, because, I mean, it could be and is that, you know, people still persist in talking about Africa as a country. I mean, it's lazy, it's racist, it's all sorts of things. And I think when you start to do more work, and, you know, the best teachers of geography are people in my mind who do more work, they think more, they challenge themselves more, they ask themselves some questions about the assumptions but from which they're starting from. And when you do that, you find these very, very good geography teachers, very, very good teachers, where actually they are finding out more, they're starting to ask themselves more questions, and in that they come across to the students with that, you know, they know more about what it is they're going to actually try and convey to young people. So I think it's incumbent upon the teacher to find out more, to know more, and to explore more, and to put themselves in a vulnerable position sometimes, to acknowledge the fact they know less than they think they know about some things, rather than just simply, I'm going to teach what I know, I'm going to teach in the way I have always taught it, but they do it slightly differently. Otherwise, I think you get the same old results. You know, so I don't know, if you're in a school setting and when people are making choices, and let's say the school has 30% black students, and geography's ended up with 5% doing it at GCSE and 5% at A level, then there is a problem. And I think you have to start asking yourself some questions. Why is this persistent as it is?
What are your answers to that then?
Well, as I said, Bill, I have no answers. And actually, if you're looking for answers which are sort of like the answer, I don't think there is the answer. I think what you have got is an approach to take. And in that approach you take, then you may go down, in some cases, a cul-de-sac where it doesn't actually work out the way you'd like it to work out. Or you might actually open a few doors where you think, oh, that's an interesting line. That's getting some returns. That's getting some sort of positive results. I have to say, I haven't taught for 20 years. So maybe I'm the last person you should be asking as such. But when I've seen people who've turned it around, or not turned it around, but actually seen some changes, it's been because they've taken a slightly different approach.
Although you say you haven't taught for 20 years, it's only 2 years since you've left your role as,
yes,
as an assistant principal.
Yes, yeah.
So you have been in school,
yes,
up until, yeah, 2 years ago. Mm. So you've had that that management perspective.
Yeah, maybe I'm talking like a manager. You know, as opposed to somebody in the classroom setting. In the classroom setting, I mean, when we were talking before, and it wasn't a black student, but it was a white student who, the first year of doing A-level geography, he clearly disliked me. And I have to say, I didn't really like him. He didn't turn up for my field trip to North Wales. And I was ringing him up, I was rang his parents, and they said, what can we do? But when we were teaching the second year, well, I was teaching the second year of the A-level, it was the EdExcel, and we're teaching political geography. And I've said to you, it was a question around a multipolar, bipolar and unipolar world. And I was really into it. And he got into it, you know, and massively into it. And he wrote me a card afterwards just thanking me for, you know, getting him interested in it. But in his year group, we had about five students who, there were about 15 in the class, five who were non-white. And we went to North Wales. And one of the lads, he was a Yemeni lad, he went with us and he went out and bought himself a new coat. And my son was in the sixth form as well at the same time. And he said, oh, do you know so-and-so's bought himself a new coat? I said, why? Because he's going away with you on the field trip. And he was so excited about going on this field trip that he bought himself a new coat. And for me, keeping him on that course, getting him through the course itself, and taking these slightly different, you know, just basically just offering them something slightly different, did seem to work that particular year.
I'm going to fire a question out to you, if you don't mind. You don't have to answer this one. But seeing as Donald doesn't know the answer, For those of you who work in schools, do any of you have any sorts of policies that look at changing the diversity of the geography that you teach? And have you ever looked at the diversity? Because quite often geography and the audiences that we get here even are not particularly diverse. That looks like a no then. I'll let you think about that one for later.
Well, maybe, I mean, you've asked that question, and maybe that is a question to ask ourselves. If we haven't asked ourselves that question, then maybe we should ask that question, because if we do ask that question, then we might begin to think about how can we address it.
Mm.
And that's why I said from the outset, I do not have the answer, but I think if we begin to think about the problem, then you might begin, and if you see it as a problem, as something which needs to be changed, we might begin to actually approach it slightly differently.
I know the GA has asked these questions, and so has the RGS in the past.
Yes, I know. Yeah. I've been asked when I've been here before, 20 years ago as well.
Yes. Okay, well, part that one. I want to go back to what you were talking about fieldwork and the importance of fieldwork then.
The National Festival of Fieldwork is coming this June. Set up by the GA's Fieldwork and Outdoor Learning Special Interest Group, the National Festival of Fieldwork is designed to encourage schools to get involved in fieldwork activities. Fieldwork is an essential part of geographical education that creates long-lasting memories for students and inspires them to explore and investigate the world around them. To get involved and to find out more about what you can do with your school, visit our website at www.geography.org.uk and download free resources to use in your locality and beyond.
This idea of space and whose space, whose place. And while we were preparing for this, I had a look at a Guardian article. It talked about the UK's national parks being largely white and middle class. That was the line of the Guardian article. And you've set up groups to challenge that. So I thought I'd ask you about a walking group that we're going back a while, 2004 you set up.
Well, it's called 100 Black Men Walk. And it was a play on the Million Man March, which was in, I don't know, late 90s, which was in the United States. We never got a million, but we got 100 over a course of a period of time. The walk got set up by myself and two black male friends. We were all in our 40s. And I think the main reason why we wanted to do it was for the two main reasons. One, physical health, and one, mental health. We're guys in our 40s, and we wanted to look at those issues. And we wanted the companionship of one another. And I know from my own personal perspective that I'd always walked in the countryside. I liked going to the countryside, but I was also very aware of feeling sometimes very visible, and visible in a way in which I didn't want to be visible. Not sure how I might be received when I was in that sort of space as such. And, you know, I could be here and tell you lots of incidences where I felt not very comfortable in the countryside. And I wanted to be going out in the countryside with guys, friends, where we could go out and we could be a body of people enjoying this particular space. And that's where we started from. Initially, primarily about a group of friends who happened to be black males in our 40s, wanting to enjoy the great British countryside.
Is this an issue for young black boys that they don't do that sort of, they don't see that sort of thing as an activity? Because I think back to what I was doing as a fell runner, there were no black fell runners. I ran with Dark Peak, and I still don't think there are any. Is it this feeling of exclusion that puts people off?
Yeah, I think it is. I'd like to say it wasn't, but I mean, I think when I go out into the countryside, I'm often the only person of colour. Still, when I've been out in the countryside with our walking group and you see another group of people who happen to be maybe an Asian group, it's still a bit of a surprise. Now, even if people feel very comfortable with that, the fact it's still a bit of a surprise is not really how it should be. So I think that's a problem. And I think that organizations are trying to address that. I know the Peak District National Park, they've been working with Mosaic, which is a Sheffield-based organization, who've just received a big sum of money to facilitate more rangers who are from Black and minority ethnic backgrounds, so that in turn can encourage more people to from such communities to be out in the countryside. I think we're starting to see some of that change. If you go out into the countryside in the Peak District, you will start to see that. I once went up a few years ago up to Scarfell, and we're in a youth hostel, and there was a family there which happened to be an Asian family, and it was a woman who was in her hijab, and I felt, this is brilliant. You know, that's this family were there. The fact I noticed them tells me something, because it was a surprise to see this family there. It's not what I expected. Now, it happened to be also a time when we'd taken our group of 15 or 20 of us up to Scarfell, towards Scarfell, so a group of 20 Black people, male and female, up in Scarfell. So it could have been that some people in that area would have thought, wow, this is a bit different, but that's how it should be.
Mm. And you've added females there, because it's changed, hasn't it? The group started as 100 Black men walking, but actually now it's called
Walk for Health.
Yes.
And it changed because basically that's what it is. It's Walk for Health, which happens to be of men and women.
How many young people are you attracting?
Not that many. And it's probably got a age and a class dimension. So actually many of the people there probably come from a slightly middle-class professional background, which therefore you've got acting in all of this, then that dynamic of race, class and age. All of those dynamics are taking place at the same time, which again, going back to the earlier question, you know, if you start to ask yourself questions about why is geography as white as it is and not as diverse as it should be, then I think you've got to begin to ask yourself some questions around dynamics such as age, class, power, location, all those sort of things. The things which geography does do.
Mm. Do you challenge the marketing? Has the group got that far? So, and you talked about how you can see the ethnicity changing in terms of some of the workers. And that's an interesting thing to see somebody as a Black role model working in the national park. Mm. Does the group challenge? Does the group talk about how you should do your marketing?
No, we don't do any marketing.
And not in terms of marketing for you, but I mean in terms of when you're talking as a group to say the national park, and how would they encourage people to use the space better, or in not necessarily better, but in different ways?
Well, I'd have to say the group itself, I'll be honest with you, we do not concern ourselves with how the Peak District National Park, et cetera, does what it does. What we concern ourselves is that we meet the first Saturday of the month and we go for a walk. And what we want from that walk is that we enjoy it. And that's all we want from it. Now, if that then has a political dimension to it as a consequence, which is we're out as a group, sometimes up to 20 people walking through the countryside. And if it has that consequence, that's brilliant, but that's not our intent. Our intent is very, very narrow and simple. Group of people going out for a walk. In many respects, no different to any other group which is going out. The only difference is skin colour.
But then there is another element to it as well, isn't there? Because once you get people in the countryside talking, not only do they enjoy themselves, but they open up to conversations that they wouldn't have elsewhere.
Oh, God, absolutely. I mean, the conversations, which we all know when we go walking, it's walking and talking seems to facilitate an infinite array of questions or of conversations, which are, in my mind, really, really helpful for well-being in every respect. Now, people talk there about work, they talk about, you know, recently, because we're of that age, but people talk about grief, death and grief, people, you know, in the group who've died. And we talk about that. And we talk about mortality. We talk about illness. We talk about our grandchildren. All of those things we talk about. And that's, the countryside gives you the space to do that. Yes, and we talk politics. We do talk about the fact that we've been going for 20 years and the fact that actually in those 20 years we've seen other groups spring up as well. I wouldn't say as a consequence of us, but they've sprung up. So for instance, you've got groups like Kinder in Colour, you've got Black Girl Hiking Group, we've got the Muslim Hikers. There's a whole range of different groups which now exist in different locations around the country. I think that's fantastic. You know, and if we've played any part at all in sort of like acting as a sort of inspiration, then that's fantastic. But it wasn't our intention.
So you don't work with schools to encourage new people to come. They just come.
The group sounds very narrow, doesn't it? I'd have to say the group is a group which goes. It's just a group which goes out for itself to do what it does.
But you haven't aged, all of you, 20 years, and it's still the same group.
No, we have new people coming in and out, and we have some younger people, which is people in their 40s. They're very young, they're whippersnappers. It has grown. Some people do it for a while, some people drop off and so forth. We did have one occasion, I think it was 2018, we got quite a lot of interest. I think we had Claire Balding first did this on Ramblers.
Oh, yeah, that was, I saw that.
What's it called again now? Ramblers?
Rambling.
Rambling, yeah.
Rambling with...
Yeah, and someone heard us, a theatre producer heard us, and she basically wrote a play based on us, or she was inspired by us, and she called it 100 Black Men Walking. And it's actually on at the moment, I think, down in London. Yeah, the Royal Court. And that was really good fun to have these people walk with us and get some ideas and so forth, and then to see the play itself. So again, although we've not set out to be an inspiration, just by doing our own thing, we seem to have actually triggered thoughts and activities elsewhere.
Well, I read a quote about that. It's on at the Royal Court Theatre, if any of you are in London.
And it's good. Yes.
It's written by the rapper Testament.
Yes, he was on Radio 6 recently. Yes.
Yeah. Otherwise known as Andy Brooks. And he said the Eclipse Theatre came to him and gave him this brief. We'd like you to write something about the Black Men's Walking Group in Sheffield. Also tie together 500 years of Black British history. That was the brief. So it starts off with, it's three characters, isn't it?
It's three characters. And I've got to say, I'm going to claim this. When he came on the walk with his producer, and it was a September and it was a rainy day, and we go to the top of Ringinlow, if anyone knows Sheffield, and you've got the Roman Road. And I said to the group in my sort of teacherish way, this is the Roman Road. And so they went, what Roman Road? I said, what we're walking on is the Roman Road. And Testament just ran away with that idea. And actually they incorporated it into the play itself there, Septimus, et cetera, et cetera. It was a great occasion to see how these creatives, they only need a few things and then they can run with it. And they did.
Talk us through the play without the denouement.
Yeah, I'm always doing that. Basically, it's three characters, three different backgrounds. One's a doctor, one's, I can't remember what one is. So they're three middle-aged Black men who go out walking. And they walk and they talk about their lives and they talk about their trials and tribulations, the difficulties in their lives, the complications, etc. there, which is what we do on a walk. And as they walk, they bump into someone, a young woman, who acts as a sort of someone who's a bit like this, creates a bit of a tension in the group dynamics. Because I think she's a ghost, actually. And it's a ghost of the past. And in that comes this whole idea about the Romans and the Septimus and people walking along that way there. So it's really that sense of saying that in that backstory about Black people have been in Britain for a very long while. Their presence has been in Britain for a very long while. And then the fourth story is about the three men and their lives.
And it is about getting people out and getting students out. We go right back to what you were saying earlier about encouraging that.
Yeah. Well, I forgot to say about, I said about my geography trip to Kinder Scout. I've got three other trips which I remember really, really well. I know dates well. 1969, I remember going home and saying to my mother, they've got a school trip to Ireland. I want to go. And she went, well, there were three of us, three boys, one after the other. You know, so I was 9, older brother was 10, younger brother was 8. Said, well, I can send two of you. And it cost £13. So we both of us went on this school trip. And I remember meeting up, and we go on the coach, and we stopped at Shrewsbury. And I still like going to Shrewsbury now, because there was a big loop in the river, the meander, but I didn't know it was called a meander at the time. And we stopped inside of it. And we walked around this meander. And I thought, what is this? This river does this big bend. And I just wanted to know what it was. And from there, we went across the Holyhead, caught the ferry across. And we're in Ireland, in Dublin. And someone came up to me and said to me,
age nine,
Black boy. Basically, you're Black, those words, you can imagine some of the words, and then said, you're from Wales. So in their idea, people were in Wales. but it was that travel, that journey for me really excited me. And, you know, that stayed with me throughout. I'm not a big traveller. I like to know about Britain.
And you don't have to go very far, as we were saying. Our students would go from Aston on the east side of Sheffield and go into the Peak District. Mm. And for them, they crossed the frontier. Mm. Most of them had never been.
Yeah.
Actually, I did what was called a hill walking leadership course from Rotherham Council. And then they said, well, you can't take them onto Kinder because it's over 1,000 feet and you're only insured to up to 1,000 feet. So you can't take them onto
leadership for you.
So I should have been the NLC instead of yes. So I couldn't go. But we took them for a week from a scout centre. Mm. And I'm sure all of you will know that that's what students talk to you about for years afterwards. We were just talking, weren't we, about a student of mine who invited me to her school. She's a head teacher of a primary school and one of my ex-students, and said, come and have a look at my school. And she's retiring this year. So I don't know how old that makes me, but it's a bit scary. But what she remembered and what she talked about was obviously the field trips. Mm,
yeah.
So even though they're difficult to do, they're the things that children hold.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I've been talking there about health a lot. I mean, when you introduced me, you talked about what I'm doing currently with the barbers. I'll try and connect it with what I've talked about before. But what I'm currently doing is I'm working with a project with an organisation in Sheffield called Sheffield African Caribbean Mental Health Association. And when I first came to Sheffield in the late 80s, I found out about this group. And it still continues to this day, focused on the mental health of Black African and Caribbean people. And to me, this is so, so important still, because you see it in schools, you know, the number of Black boys who get excluded, the number of Black boys who still to this day then progress to places like pupil referral units and then to prison and so forth. What we see in this project is, and I was startled when I started the project. The aim of the project is that I'll go out to barbers and I'll work with barbers to continue the conversation around mental health, which is taking place in the barbershops and the customers. And then that conversation will validate, you know, the whole idea of being able to talk about mental health. It might help people to be signposted to where they might get support, etc., etc. Then the need for that is still there, because Black men are five times more likely to be detained under the Mental Health Act than white men. If you then connect it back with schools, Black Caribbean boys are three times more likely to be excluded. To my mind, there is a connection. And therefore, you know, there's been a theme for me throughout my working life of trying to, you know, support all youngsters, but I'm talking here at this particular point in my life there where I see this as a continuing need and not that much has changed. That's what really, really knocks me back a bit, that not as much has changed as should be. And that's what's sustained me in the 40 years of my education, that actually, you know, it was a privilege to be in education, to work in education, to feel as if that you could contribute to making a difference with young people. And, you know, as a geographer, if I was able to, as a teacher of geography, able to help young people to just see it slightly differently, experience it slightly differently, and if that contributed to their overall well-being, regardless of the grade they might get, then that's what I felt mattered to me.
How much did you use that when you were an assistant principal? Because that school was very ethnically diverse.
Yeah,
that sixth form college.
Absolutely. 80% of the sixth form was non-white. All right, so 20% was white. So you'd have 35% Pakistani, 10% Arab Yemeni, 10% Somali, 10% West African. So the issue of, you know, plurality was really, really there all the time. So you had to recognize people's backgrounds. You had to recognize that people came with a backstory as well. That backstory wasn't just simply that they lived down the road, etc. They had the lineage which went way back, and that lineage actually impacted them. So for instance, if for instance there was a bombing in Yemen, then actually you could have people in your sixth form who they were related to those people. It wasn't some faraway place. It was connected to them. And, you know, that to my mind, you know, sometimes was lost by some people. Oh, yeah, it's over there. You know, if it's not affecting us here in Britain, doesn't really matter, but it affected them and it mattered to them. And often they felt as if they were being ignored because people didn't acknowledge that this was the case. We had students who came from the Congo, and I had responsibility for safeguarding as the vice principal. And you'd hear these stories when you were talking to the students there, which was going to feed into how they experienced the school setting, the college setting. And they didn't want it to be talked about all the time. But now and again, it needed to be acknowledged, needed to be recognized that this was part of their story as well.
And geography can draw that out really well if it's given space to.
And yes, and sensitively and carefully, because no one wants to, again, back to that visibility, don't point me out as the Black person in the class. But if it's carefully done, carefully considered, they'll actually make, having some understanding of the war, you know, they take the Congo. Why is the Congo as it is? Well, you can't answer it in a nice, easy question, answer, but there's lots of reasons why it is as it is and why it's been a country plagued by exploiters, basically. And it has been the case for the last 150 years.
And we were talking, weren't we, about the danger of a single story. That's Chimamanda Adichie Ngozi. She's got a wonderful TED talk, which I'm sure most of you have listened to, but where she talks about the danger of a single story.
Yeah.
And that brings in the elements of the Biafran conflict.
Yeah. And I liked what you said about the single story, because that always makes me think about there isn't a fact. What you've got are interpretations. You've got different ways of looking at it, different lenses, etc. And sometimes you want to hear that lens coming from the students, the lens coming from a different community, the lens coming from a different way of looking at it, which again can be very challenging. You know, it's maybe making you feel as if you're not the expert anymore. You're not this vessel which has got all the information, all the insight and all the right answers. No, you're not always. Sometimes somebody else has.
Which makes sometimes the teacher feel uncomfortable.
Very uncomfortable indeed. And again, the best teachers I've seen are those teachers who've been able to live with a bit of feeling a bit of discomfort. I don't know if I ever was. I mean, I felt I was quite good at discomfort in a classroom, because when I first started teaching in Coventry, and it was a mainly white school, and there'd be 35 kids and 35 white kids, and most of the teachers were white, I felt very uncomfortable. Simple as that. As the black person in the classroom and the black teacher, I felt very uncomfortable, always, at the early days.
That's really great. I was wanting to say shocking, but it's I'm not quite sure what the word is for that, but it's just something I would never have felt.
It scared me at first. When I was on teaching practice, I was scared. And I joked there before about borrowing a pair of Doc Martens, but in this class, on teaching practice, there was just a row of skinheads, these 15-year-old skinheads. These were these white lads who I considered to be quite scary. These are the lads who were chasing you down the road, etc. Now, you flip it round to the way in which black boys are sometimes seen as aggressive, etc. For me, black boys were not scary. It was those white skinheads in that classroom and those lads there. And they might be wrongly, they probably were very nice lads. In fact, most of them were very nice lads. But I brought with me my own perceptions, my own prejudices, my own experiences into that setting. And therefore, I had to stand back a bit to actually say, no, that's not the case.
You've not just walked with the walking group, and not just worked with them. You've done many other things in terms of looking at diversity. You've worked with the Development Education South Yorkshire.
Mm-hmm, yes.
Which is an organisation that's to promoting diversity.
Yeah. I mean, Christine and I are working with DEXI. I mean, for me, one of the interesting things there for me, and again, back into challenge, is the work they've been doing, for instance, on gender action and, you know, exploring issues around misogyny, etc. And that's made me have to stop again and challenge my own thinking and my own practice, my own way of being as well. And again, you know, you can see some of the reaction, you know, sometimes if you push, you get a reaction. And that push, that reaction in some respects reflects that sort of vulnerability, which maybe some men, maybe I feel at times, which exists out there.
It's quite challenging because it's, when you look at that sort of maleness, mm-hmm. for some men to look at it in a different way.
Yeah. For me personally, the way in which I've had to equate it with is that it's made me, my own sort of like difficulties or issues or ways which I've tried to engage with gender action and misogyny, etc., has been to try and it's made me think about, well, how might white people be responding to some of the discussions around race, around ethnicity, and all what's going on at the moment about woke and this, that, and the other, et cetera, that there is a bit of a reaction. But that might be because people do feel quite sort of sensitive and a bit sort of like it's challenging to what you know and challenging to who you think you are. That type of challenge, I think, does feed into the way in which you are as a teacher, the way you are as a teacher of geography as well, because you bring yourself to the classroom. You know, you don't just bring a set of information, a body of information. You bring yourself into that classroom setting. You bring yourself into the relationships you're going to have with what it is you're actually trying to convey to young people. And you bring yourself into the relationships which you have with people.
So you have to challenge it. You have to challenge anti-woke.
Yes, you have to. Well, you have to challenge that reaction to woke. If woke is what they, you know, Before it was politically correct. Well, what's politically correct about not using sexist language, not using racist language? Now, I'd put my hand up and say I'm politically correct if that's the case, and I'm woke if that's the case, because it's wrong to talk in that way. It's wrong to think in that way. So we should be unapologetic about that.
It's an area that's easy to avoid as a teacher if you're not, because it's so challenging with some students.
Well, it is. Then you go into this idea that teaching and geography is apolitical, but it's not. You know, we all bring with us a set of ideas, a set of values, which in themselves are political. And when I hear people say, well, I'm apolitical, I'm not. No, what we have is political. There's a set of choices being made. Those choices may be dictated to us from somewhere else. It could be from the government. It could be from your MATS leaders. Decisions have been made. They're not just being given on from high.
And it brings us to something we were talking about earlier as well, before the podcast, but about the criticality that's needed as a geographer. Mm. It's very important to have critical thinking.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. I mean, I don't think you can dispute it. Like critical thinking, though, where you're asking yourself questions all the time, and it's tiring. And I think it is tiring because it's a struggle. And but at the same time, it's exciting, I would imagine. I think it's exciting because it keeps you fresh. It keeps you wanting to find out more. You want to know more. You want to read more. You want to be engaged in conversations. You want to meet people who actually make you think and make you actually ponder how what it is where you are at this particular time. That, to my mind, is what's exciting about education. And if it isn't that, then I don't know what it is.
And I think geography is at the forefront of that sort of excitement, because it gives you that space to do that if you create it.
We talked earlier there about when I said to you about that particular EdExcel course, which was the political geography unit, which I absolutely adored. And, it's 2008 and it's talking about what sort of future world order we're going to have. Is it going to be a unipolar? Is it going to be a bipolar or multipolar? What will be the consequences, etc.? And every time you listen to the Today program, I think of that. I think, well, geography's been saying that. And I said to you at the time, let's not even talk about climate change, because geography's been saying that for 40 odd years. Everything which is out there now, geography's been saying it. So geography's got that prescience about it as well. And maybe we don't shout it from the rooftop, but I'm a someone. Yeah, I think it's been telling us so much. I don't think it's doom laden. It's just telling us this is what our field of knowledge has got to contribute to the world as it is.
I've got a quote somewhere from Robert McFarlane. I'm going to mess about with it because I haven't got it written down. But he said something like, he's an English academic who writes all sorts of books about, largely about place, but he said, if I had my time again, I'd be a geographer, because geography is where it's happening. Geography is where the questions are being asked. Mm-hmm. Geography is a place of excitement. Mm-hmm. And that might be where we leave our talk, I think, and open it up to some questions if you have any.
Oh, thank you so much. I found that a bit emotional at one point. That's why I had to take a bit of a break. Thank you for your honesty, your genuineness and your openness. A couple of comments that spread some things and then lead to a question. So I love that kind of thought of like trying to move from the fear zone to the learning zone to the growth zone. And it makes me feel uncomfortable to do so, but joyously so as a geographer, because my core identity is as a geographer. And I think that can be a superpower, which can make us comfortable with our discomfort and enjoy that and absorb that learning. And then to link to that is that I then try to live my authentic self. And my existence and me going about my daily life is, unfortunately, a political act, because it's made to be a political act. Me being who I am is a political act. Being invisible, because you were talking about visibility earlier, is a political act. I try and pay my privilege forward to kind of, be the job that I am and educate people. But there's this visibility paradox where me as a trans person, perhaps yourself as a black person, where we just feel that just being ourselves and visible, the onus seems to fall on us all the time. to educate people. So the question for you is, how do you square that circle yourself, being a jobpreneur, an educator who prides himself, taking joy in this kind of thing, learning, teaching, which then exposes ourselves even more? And what would you say is the best example or the best thing an ally can do to support us so we're not so emotionally exhausted all the time?
I think on many occasions, I've tried not to be visible. I've tried to avoid things. I've tried to just keep my head down. But it never really works because there's too much happening. And if you're in a school setting, educational setting, there's far too much happening for that to be the case. And therefore, you find yourself that actually you're having to have a position on things, which means that, you know, you're having to, even in a conversation with a colleague, where you're having to have a position, which is challenging the orthodox, it's challenging a set of assumptions. And then you have to say it as it is, as you feel it is. A lot of the time you do it tactfully, you try and do it carefully, you try so that you're not upsetting people. But on occasions, you know, you will have ruffled a few feathers, but I don't actually want to. I don't like doing it. So that's the first bit. On the second bit there about allyship, it's an idea which I've only recently come about, allyship. It's really, I just looked for people who wanted to engage in the conversation, who wanted to hear you out. And in hearing you out, they themselves would be pushing their own thinking. So we're having an honest conversation as best as we can. And sometimes that would mean that they would take on a position. So for instance, at my sixth form, myself and the principal, and you have to have a close working relationship with a close colleague, but she was my ally. And she was my ally because whenever we had a situation, let's take an example like this. We excluded youngsters from time to time. But we were often the last, we were literally the last people to want these people to go. We'd have lots of our colleagues wanted them to go. And we would be seen as, these two are always undermining us as teachers. They're not supporting us because they're keeping these youngsters in. They're giving them a second and a third chance. But for me, that was my sort of like, I'm here as well, trying to balance all these different things out. And my principal can hear my voice, which is saying, look, if we exclude this young person, which might be the thing we might be the easier thing to do, this young person's route now is school to prison. And it's a reality. And it's something which she used to say all of the time to colleagues. So they knew exactly that actually, if you were going to bring it to the table, it had to be a very good case.
Anything else? Do you have anything else that you want to add?
No, not really. I mean, other than to say thank you very much. Thank you, Christine, for inviting me. I might go back to your question, which is about how do you keep going? Well, before I came here today, I have to say, I hadn't really thought about geography for ages. And people say to me about having retired from education, do you think about it much? I go, no, I don't. And I don't miss it. But as soon as you get back into the environment, you somewhere have a passion and an excitement. And it's exciting to be here. It's exciting to hear people talk about geography into, I said to you at the beginning, just seeing all the sort of banners around there. And you think, yeah, that's brilliant. I remember feeling that way in the classroom. I remember feeling that way of wanting to actually get a group of youngsters together there and teach them this particular subject or teach them a particular topic and be, and sometimes, a lot of the time,
being really, really excited about it. And, you know, your children thinking, oh, Dad, you don't go and talk about this to your... And they go, yeah, I do. And we probably all have it there where your children think, oh, I'm bored hearing this, but you're not bored talking about it. And hopefully that when you convey it to your class, that it doesn't come across like that. It comes across for them because it is for them the first time. And it has to be that first time they're hearing from you, that excitement. And I think I did try to do that with the classes, and I wouldn't say all of the time and not all the time successfully, but I did try to actually convey that excitement and convey that passion about the subject geography I taught and about education in general.
It isn't just children, is it? Because you enthuse your walkers as well, I assume, because they always have a go at me, oh no, John, don't talk to us about the mind thrust again.
I know, they get bored with me.
Yeah, exactly the same. Yes. It's been a pleasure talking to you today. I hope everyone has got something out of this. I certainly have. I did a fair bit of preparation because it was an area I didn't know much about, because I haven't been to a barber's for about 20 years. But it's absolutely fascinating.
Just a little trim.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, John.
It's been really, really enjoyable.